What's up, listeners? This is Abir Sigdar. I hope everyone is enjoying the spring, at least if it's warm in your part of the country. It's mostly been warm here in Kentucky, but some days our weather has been pretty indecisive. Anyways, for this episode of Local Global Leaders, titled Social Work with a Law Degree, I spoke with Angela Evans, who is the Fayette County Attorney here in Kentucky. During the interview, she gave really thoughtful answers about her passion for a fair justice system, and she also discussed her various government roles that she's had at the state and local levels, in both appointed and elected positions. It was great talking with a fellow lawyer, especially one who internalizes the multifaceted aspects of our criminal justice system, and someone who thinks about overall reform to juvenile justice, to maintaining social services, and more. I also loved discussing her background studying social work in college and her time as a public defender and how both those past roles informed her work. Hope you enjoy listening.
All right, greetings, listeners. This is Abir Sigdar with another episode of the Local Global Leaders podcast, and I'm honored today to be in here in County Attorney Angela Evans' beautiful office here in this beautiful building in downtown Lexington. County Attorney Evans, thank you so much for inviting me here.
Thank you for inviting me. Yeah, I always like talking and sharing my story and, you know, letting people know that they too can do things, and there's no one path to getting to where you might find yourself. So, thank you.
Oh, of course. Yeah, that's a great thing to hear, especially as a coming, I'm a fellow lawyer who's never actually practiced law, so I can definitely understand that. But yeah, so excited, and yeah, I've been, you know, hearing a lot about your work. I don't think we actually met, but I saw you last year at the WUKY Women of Distinction event in March of last year. I mean, I just saw you get honored there, heard a lot about your work and, you know, the great things you're doing. So just heard about your work there, and then very luckily got this podcast, and I was like, I got to make sure I interview her at some point. So
well, thank you. I'm honored. Thank you.
But yeah, first, just starting off, I want to know who Angela Evans is and how she became a leader. So what do you want our listeners to know about you right off the bat?
Well, I'm a native of Lexington, so I'm born and raised here, but I was also that kid who thought they were just going to be in Lexington and then leave. You know, so every time I go talk to high school students, I ask, okay, who are the ones that, like, yeah, grew up in Lexington, but now I'm ready to spread my wings and, like, to come home for holidays. And inevitably, there's some kid that raises their hand, and I'm like, okay, well, so I'm talking to you, so you never know what can happen that brings you home. And now I think it's a little more, people think about it more intentionally. You know, there is kind of the movement to maybe come home eventually, like that's in people's plans, but that was not my plan. You know, back in the 90s, people left and they didn't come back, you know, so I do kind of giggle about that. But no, I'm born and raised here. My mom was a teacher. She taught in public school for 30 some odd years. My dad did practice law here in town. So, you know, I'm a Lexington kid, you know. but went away to undergrad and went to Atlanta, went to historically black school, Clark Atlanta University, shout out. And then law school at the University of Tennessee. So again, I was not planning on coming back to Lexington. It was like, you know, each step just goes someplace else. But you know, things happen. And, you know, I'd gotten so close to having a job in New York City with the ACLU. Like, was one of the finalists. They flew me in and everything. But it didn't happen. And, of course, devastated at that time because I was kind of like you. I wasn't necessarily going to practice. I was going to go, you know, save the world, lobby, you know, work on healthcare, actually, is kind of where I thought I was going to go. But you know, came back home, and, you know, home is a good place to be. You know, I just started getting roots. You know, I clerked with a circuit court judge here in town. That was my first, you know, legal job, and learned a lot there. And, you know, by the time I graduated kind of from law school, it was either policy work or public defender. And then having been a clerk with the circuit court judge, I was like, I want to be a public defender. My bachelor's is in social work. So I really just wanted to help people. That's why I went to law school. Didn't know really what shape or form, but, you know, thought maybe healthcare based on my internship that I had when I was an undergrad. But, yeah, got to law school, clerk with the judge. I was like, no, criminal defense. Let's try that. And you know, it was, I got to deal with all kinds of different people, which, again, social work background, so that helped out. And I enjoyed that job. But then I wanted to do something more. Mm-hmm. You know, I was still pretty young, and, well, I was young, considering now. And, just still didn't want to get pigeonholed. Mm-hmm. So I knew I wanted that for my career. So then I'd gone to the Secretary of State's office and then the Attorney General's office, and things just kind of happen. And I knew I wanted to be more involved in government. Leadership, not quite sure what that looked like for me, but I always was the kid that, you know, was on student councils. Okay. Was never the president, so I wasn't that popular. But, you know, always took the lead when something needed to happen. And even in law school, you know, there were elections. You know, I was voted the 1L representative, things like that, where I got to be involved. So I was just, that was just always me. And that comes from, you know, my mom being involved in education associations and her sorority, you know. So that was just something that was instilled in me from an early age, that you need to be involved. Mm-hmm. You know, whether or not you have a leadership role, that's something, you know, that's something else. But inevitably, if you're that engaged and the personality that I have, I'm like, nope, okay, fine, I'll just do it. Or let's do it this way. So a combination of them, you know, that was always there for me. And it just took its shape and eventually leads here. I don't know, that's a very vague and simple kind of explanation. But leadership in government. So I was a friend of mine, we were just looking to be more engaged. We were actually looking for mentors, you know, of like how to navigate our government career. And I will say a lady talked to me about Emerge Kentucky, which is a program that, you know, trains Democratic women to run for office. Now, I wasn't thinking about running for office. That's not the intention that I had when we had lunch with her, but I'd heard about it, had seen it, and finally the stars aligned. I was able to apply for it, and someone was willing to be my sponsor. So mm-hmm. someone saw enough in me to say, I think this is a program you should do. And things just kind of took off from there. And what I tell women that go through the program, I'm like, okay, you might not know what you're going to run for, but now you've put yourself out there and people now know that you've been through this program. So you have the basic tools of what it takes to run a campaign. Mm-hmm. So now people will be seeking you out. Now, you don't have to go for every office someone throws at you, but you have now made it known to the public that, hey, I want to run and be a political leader. And that's kind of what happened with me. Like, I don't think the ink was dry on my certificate before someone said, hey, I think you should run for city council. And so it just kind of took off from there.
That's awesome. I really appreciate hearing that story. I can definitely relate to it a lot as somebody leaving Kentucky for school and then being like, oh, I think, like, I was in D.C. and I'm like, I think I want to work here. But then I think for me, a big realization, I was like, the COVID pandemic hit and I'm like, I actually miss home. And now I'm lucky to be able to come back home and work here. So really appreciate hearing that. I appreciate hearing your parent. You said your mom was a public school teacher.
Yes.
That's awesome. I was very lucky to get to, that was my first career move, get to teach public school. And I think that's a really valuable experience for leadership.
Yeah. And that was not going to be what I did. So all my role models are teachers. So maybe that's where some of the, let me just do it.
Yeah.
I think comes in. But yeah, I remember going to visit my mom when I'd be on college break or something, and a classroom full of 30 kids. Like, that was, it's like, this, talk about management and leadership. But I knew early on that wasn't for me, but completely and totally appreciate it, obviously. And like I said, my first mentors are school teachers and involved in, you know, policy, advocating for teachers in public education. So I think that's where, I guess, maybe the government political side of me, you know, came out too.
And do you feel like that may have partly been what drew you back? Yeah, like drew you back here to Kentucky. And, you know, Kentucky's a huge public education state. People are huge fans of our, you know, like in the state,
they
uphold public education. They love their teachers. Do you feel like, you know, like in a sense, maybe that's what kind of kept you back home and in office?
You know what? no, to be honest. But it was where, you know, I feel like I had a core group of people. Again, I think being the child of a teacher, mm-hmm. a public school teacher, is just something different. And again, the women that I knew and the teachers that I knew were still very much engaged. Like, those were my first memories of political involvement. They're campaigning for somebody, mm-hmm. you know, they're going to conventions. So I think it stood out to me that way. Like, that was laying the foundation of, you know, even if you're not running for office, you need to be engaged in maybe just your association. So that's a real union thing for me. You know, I'm very much, you know, I am pro-union, even though it's difficult. HR is very difficult, and I understand the challenges, but so I think educators and growing up with educators, probably that was just the core that I had. So when I started thinking about running for office, you know, I'd seen it. And then I get Democrats, teachers generally are Democrats. You know, the Democratic parties are, teachers union is a big thing. So it kind of felt like I was with my own people, or people that had known me for a while too. So, you know, very much like-minded. So that was a comfort in that space. And then just expanding it to, you know, other unions mm-hmm. was obviously an easy connection to make, because I understand the value, you know. I remember, like I said, mom doing activities and, you know, them phone banking for specific candidates. Like, I remember mm-hmm. that as a kid, and going to their board meetings and just different discussions that they would have. So they were, I didn't want their profession, but they were my core and understanding kind of what it meant to be an advocate.
Yeah.
And be engaged in government and politics.
Yeah. Yeah, I really appreciate hearing that. I had a similar thing with my mom. She was a doctor. She still is a doctor, but tried to get me to, like, go into medicine. And I saw what she did. I'm like, oh, this is too hectic. Like, all this blood. Like, I can't work in a hospital. But I still found value in, like, I think there's a great thing in serving people and helping people. And, and you know, now I'm fortunate to, like, do a lot of research and work in mental health care, for example. Like, mm-hmm. to think that, you know, that still influenced me, even though I didn't follow that exact career path.
Yeah.
I appreciate you saying earlier too, like, how you've had both mentors and sponsors who kind of, like, you know, like, I guess the mentors more just guided your work, the sponsors more just, I don't know if there's, I can't think of the right synonym, but just literally sponsored the work. I actually spoke with a colleague about that who happens to work in government too, who they've emphasized the value of that, particularly for people who want to go into leadership at a young age. Like, can you tell us more about that and how you see those as different, mentorship and sponsorship?
Yeah. I mean, mentors are, I think, you can have a mentor for, like, a few conversations. You know, I think those can change throughout, you know, a lifespan. But, I think sponsors, I would use them as probably the ones that kind of do the action, like, mm-hmm. you know, get you in the room. I think Stacey Abrams did a little book on it, and it was like, well, yeah, I kind of get that, you know, because she explained maybe certain different levels and stuff. But, you know, my mentors have been the people that, you know, I've been able to talk to, you know, kind of guide me through, you know, that are a little more intimate, I think, maybe. Sponsors, I say, sometimes can just be the one that gets you in the room, that gets you the invitation. And, you know, but they're all still supportive of you. So it's, you know, this person was, you know, financially a sponsor to me. So that's, I think, maybe why I use that word, but also a mentor and an encourager. You need people that will be willing to, and we're talking about leadership and running for office, cut the check. Like, that's a sponsor. You know, I've got donors that, maybe have not been my mentors, but they're still supportive of me. So they're, like, in that sponsor level, kind of thinking of fundraising. But then, you know, I have mentors that are, again, a little more relational. But they're both still needed. So,
yeah,
I think that's kind of the slight difference that I make. But, you know, and they change, you know, I have people that I consider mentors that probably don't even know they've been mentors, you know, just people that you can observe from afar, or maybe you do have relationships with. So it's, I use it as a broad spectrum.
Yeah. I appreciate you saying that too, like people who don't realize they're mentors to you. I think one of my favorite feelings or interactions in life is when I tell someone, oh, hey, you're someone who inspired me, or hey, you're a mentor to me. They're like, I am?
Right,
they just
yeah.
get that look on their head. They're like, oh, I'm so excited to hear that you're like honored to hear this from me.
Right. Well, and kind of going to the sponsor and trying to think of a different example, but yeah, I mean, a sponsor can be someone that's like, and it was, talking about people who are supportive, it was someone that I never expected, didn't even really know, who was the first one to suggest to me that I should run for office. Yep. And it was someone who I knew and highly respected, but, you know, we were just, I think we were at a fair or something, and so we had some time to kind of, you know, chit-chat and get to know each other a little bit. But, you know, he was like, you know everybody here. Like, you don't stop talking. Like, you know, and he's like, and you're personable and you're smart. I don't know if I'd gone through a merge at that point or not, but, you know, knowing what his level of engagement in politics was, he was like, you should think about running for office. Like, there's just something he saw. And then that, him saying that, you know, he makes a call, or when I'm like, okay, now I'm ready, what do I do? He was like, let me call somebody who can get you in touch with somebody else to make, you know, these introductions. Mm-hmm. So not necessarily a mentor, but certainly a sponsor. So, you know, he's a champion, whatever. So, you know, it could be a one thing. It could be, you know, a couple of different things. Again, people, you don't have to really have a years long, you know, relationship with, but just people that see the potential can also help you. And that's happened a lot in my life too. Yeah. So
that's awesome to recognize. Yeah. I think that, like, it sounds like you're, like you said earlier, your motivation for leadership is more when you saw something, or you saw, you know, like, you need to be a leader. It doesn't need to be the public facing person,
right?
But you were still recognized for that. And now you're in a very public facing role. So it's interesting to make that path.
Yeah. It's not something I would have written out for myself. So I tell that to people too. Like, you can make all the plans you want, and it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to happen. I wouldn't have had this written out in my, what did they say, like on my bingo card for 10 years. it wouldn't have been, but it's worked out, and it's worked out well. And it's been because of the support, mentors, you know, that I've had throughout the years. So yeah, I laugh about it periodically. It's just funny to me.
Yeah. And that's awesome. And so, yeah, that brings us to you with your current role. How would you describe your role as the Fayette County Attorney?
I can tell you what the County Attorney's Office does. And, you know, it, which is the same throughout every county. You know, we prosecute 99% of all crimes, of criminal charges, come through the County Attorney's Office first. So we have the first bite at the apple to amend felonies if we want to, and then we prosecute all misdemeanors. So we have the first bite to do that. So, you know, all the murders and, you know, all the sexy crimes, you know, they're going to go to the Commonwealth's attorney. But we do all the misdemeanor prosecutions, as well as some of the felonies that we choose to amend down. We also do all the juvenile prosecutions and all the family court dependency, neglect, and abuse cases. So, you know, and that's a civil group, a civil court, but we still do that by statute.
Okay.
So, not necessarily prosecutors, but certainly representing the interest of the county, which does mean then questioning whether or not children should be with their parents for, you know, if they're abuse, neglect, or dependency charges. We do the juvenile prosecution, so anything from truancy to actual what we call public offenses, which would be a crime, mm-hmm. whether or not you're a juvenile or an adult. So general juvenile prosecution, as well as child support enforcement, that speaks for itself. Mm-hmm. And then we also represent all the different county offices, with the exception of Lexington's funny. I do not do anything with LFUCG. They've got their own department, but, you know, the county clerk, the PDA, the the coroner, we represent them in litigation. And then we also have a part in the property delinquent property taxes. So that's what we do in a nutshell. Now, what I do as the Fayette County attorney is very different than what someone in Kenton County or, you know, Lincoln County would do, because just by the sheer volume. So honestly, my role is more administrative. So I've got a full staff that goes to court every day and prosecutes cases. So I do more of the policy. You know, when we decided to do diversion online, you know, traffic diversion or, you know, criminal diversion, you know, those are the changes that I made. You know, I make the decisions about how we might change operations. Mm-hmm. Of course, some of the things we have to do by statute, but that, and then again, all the administrative stuff, making sure, you know, my name at the end of the day is on all the checks and all the audits. So I need to make sure, you know, we're using funds properly. You know, mm-hmm. I'm fiscally responsible, as well as just being responsible with our funds. Yeah. Because we do generate funds and we do receive money from the state. So that's kind of what I do, and just oversee everything. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a lot.
Sounds like a lot to me.
It's an executive position. So yeah, which is, you know, different from being, you know, on city council, as I did that. So it's different. But I'm enjoying it. You know, this is what I get to make the government office that I want to have, you know, get to make decisions about how it operates based on how I think, you know, a government office should operate. So, so that's what I do. My day is just a whole lot of meetings at this point. You know, I'll wander into court and let people know I'm not here just to, you know, look over your shoulder, but yeah, it's a lot of administrative, HR paperwork in meetings at this point, but it's okay. It's good stuff.
Balance those different policy areas that you have to cover, from like mental health policy to, you mentioned, traffic diversion to, I mean, juvenile versus criminal justice to the various sort of things. Like, how do you approach managing like all these areas under one office?
Yeah, I mean, I really try to talk with my staff, because we, especially in juvenile, we had a lot of statutory changes that have come from Frankfurt. So it's been a lot of communication with them about, okay, what would this look like for our office? Because mm-hmm. now we get notified, for example, we get notified of every child in Fayette County that misses more than, I think, 10, maybe 15 days of school. Like, that is now declared truant. Mm. That is a lot of children.
Yeah.
A lot of children, especially, you know, when we're talking about truancy court, you know, that we actually have a specific court for, the kids coming in there, I mean, they've missed, you know, tens, maybe even hundreds of days of school. So when we're talking about those who missed 10 to 15, you know, in a city like Lexington, I mean, that's an exponential amount of children that we now have to consider how to deal with. But we have a good relationship with public schools. Okay. And the counselors there and the people that are charged with, you know, keeping track of that for the public schools. So, yeah, it's a lot of conversations to see how my prosecutors are doing, you know, how it's changed or how it might change how they operate. Mm-hmm. Luckily, a lot of this stuff, you know, it's more like we'll just keep an eye on it, or like, yes, this is something we need to try to be more aware of. Let's mm-hmm. keep track of it to see how we might need to change how we prosecute different charges. So using House Bill 5, which no one asked for, but, you know, was a thing. But having conversations with our homelessness prevention intervention director to kind of share what my thoughts were, you know, talking to my staff about, okay, how do you all feel comfortable prosecuting it? This is what I think we should do. You know, having a game plan for something that a crime no one asked for to be a crime. And so really it's kind of making sure that my folks understand and are on board with, you know, how we decide to prosecute. Because again, we have to operate, even though we look at each case individually, we still need to present some kind of standard and uniformity in what our offers are to people. So it's having those conversations and kind of collectively deciding, yes, we all think this is the best route to go for this new charge, or hey, this new responsibility we have, let's approach it this way, and just having those conversations. Because again, we've got a lot of things that come through. So that's kind of how we've tackled it, it's just keeping that communication. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately, if there's a real discrepancy on how I feel about it or how, you know, staff feel about it, then I have to make that decision. But yeah, being the voice of, well, this is how it'll affect our office, so maybe we don't do that. You know, everyone's got an idea of what everyone else should be doing, whether it's a judge or, you know, prosecutors or defense attorneys. So making our voice known and our position known to everyone else, you know, partners, other stakeholders in the court system, and I am being partners with them, but also protecting ourselves and doing what we, because ultimately we have to seek justice in whatever realm, whether it's delinquent taxes or, you know, prosecuting DUIs or something like that. So making sure that, you know, our office is still doing right by the public and by justice and whatever comes down the pipeline. So it's a long answer. Sorry.
Oh, that's a great answer. And I know you said earlier, like, you're studying social work, that inspired you to, like, you know, want to help people. Do you feel like, I mean, I imagine studying that probably helped a lot with all the policy areas you have to deal with now, because social workers, you should be dealing with all that.
Yeah, we do everything. Yeah, I mean, you know, that was, and I didn't know what I wanted to major in when I went to law, or when I went to undergrad. But yeah, I just knew I wanted to help people. And that just came from my own faith. You know, I like I said, I knew teaching was out. I was like, nah, I can't help people that way. But then saw a poster. I had to have been in the social work department. I don't know, just walking through, and saw all of these different jobs listed, and they were all different, like literally 100 different positions, and it had social work at the top. So I was like, well, I think I want to major in social work. That sounds like all the things that I would want to do. So, yeah. And then I did my internship at a mental health institute, mental health hospital, private hospital, which was even cushier. But yeah, see, and it was an adult hospital. So seeing people with mental health issues, with drug addiction issues, and kind of getting to know them. Like, I got to do intakes and, you know, have follow-up, you know, one-on-ones with them, but seeing how some of them, usually ones with the mental illnesses, would come into the hospital versus how they would leave, you know, seeing the change once they got back on medication, it's been a phenomenal impact on, I think, how I see the world. Because just seeing someone come in who is completely just a mess, violent even. Like, yeah, we've got to keep him, like, on that unit, and he's just completely disruptive. But, you know, 3 days later, he's perfectly fine. You know, chatting away with me, I'm like, well, I think he could be my friend, you know. Or, you know, reminding me of one of my friends, or, you know, a family member, and just kind of seeing that, yeah, they're all people. And mental health, you know, specifically, I think it just stuck with me because, again, even people who were compliant on their medication could still have problems. I remember a client that he was only in the hospital because he was taking lithium, was only a prescribed dosage and everything, but it ended up he was getting poisoned by it. So it's like, oh, okay, well, now we need to adjust or get a new medication for you. So by no fault of his own, it just, the medication, his body started turning on the medication that had been helping him. So you get a different level of empathy, sympathy, I think, maybe for people. And then that's where I learned about the health insurance and how much we have left to fix. Because, you know, we did have another anecdote. There was a gentleman who was a little older, schizophrenic, very much delusional. Like, just still, he'd been, like, chronic, with just, I don't know how long he'd been diagnosed, but certainly someone that had come through the hospital before. He had private insurance, but his time had run out. And I'm like, and we're sitting in, you know, our team meeting talking about this man who is still talking about going into a deep sleep, but that we have to release him. I'm like, and as a 21-year-old, what do you mean we're going to release him? Like, he's not well yet. Well, his insurance isn't going to cover, you know, any more stays. And I just, that was devastating to me, that someone with private insurance was still not going to get the care that they clearly pay for. So that's what, I'll go to law school and fix the healthcare system. So that's what probably led me to law school. But yeah, I mean, social work and just learning about domestic violence, you know, that there's a cycle to it, which obviously, I mean, that's probably one of the highest, you know, charges that we have in the county attorney's office is, you know, domestic violence. Being able to talk to my victims' advocates and understand that there is a cycle and, you know, we can't help everyone, but yes, like being aware and understanding of that, which also helped me as a public defender that, you know, like, yes, you are the victim legally, but you are a victim. And so one, I shouldn't talk to you, but then there are services for you that perhaps you need to go seek. And, you know, understanding when, you know, the victim would come to me if she wants him out, you know, oh, we have children, and not understanding that frustration or that fear, but then also still representing my client. So yeah, being a public defender was very much social work. Yeah. I called it social work with a law degree. And one day I got so upset. I don't know what had happened. I was like, oh, why am I here? What am I doing this job? And I was like, this is social work with a law degree. Of course you're going to be here. So yeah, get to see people and, you know, whether it's talking to the parents of an adult child or a juvenile, like, you know, this isn't the worst thing. Or, hey, they really do need help. Or, I know they need help, but they're not there yet. Being able to explain, you know, people's rock bottom isn't what you think their rock bottom is. For people that had, you know, substance abuse issues. But yeah, being able to kind of meet people where they are. And that was another invaluable thing that I didn't realize I had at the time, but as I've gone through my career, yeah, I've been able to pick out some mental health cases. I'm like, oh yeah, we're not going to talk to that person. Like, we don't need to engage because that person, I can't diagnose them, but there's something there. So let's focus on what we need to do, you know, in this proceeding. They can be there. We can still go proceed and do the things we need to do. But yeah, being able to recognize when some things are off too has been helpful. But then really understanding people are people, and even the scariest person, you know, walking down the street is still, you know, a person, you know, can still, you know, give them the right amount of time and medications and help. Has the potential to be a productive person. But then people also make choices and they have to suffer those consequences too. But, but yeah, that's, yeah.
Well, yeah, it sounds like studying social work more so, it was more so the experiences you got from that than just like, you know, studying what you studied academically.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Cause I think, when I realized I knew I couldn't be a social worker, like clinical social worker. Mm-hmm. Cause yeah, I learned people don't listen to you. It's like, you know, I can tell you what you need to do, but people have, you know, their own agency. Mm-hmm. And even though I think they should do X, Y, and Z, and that would be what society would tell them that they should do, you know, you can't control what people do. So part of, I guess, the appeal of criminal law and public defense was that, okay, I can't fix your entire life, but I can help you through this one portion to kind of, that might help set you on a path or that you found yourself in because of whatever other issues that might be happening. So yes, I had to narrow the scope of how I might be able to help people, because trying to help fix someone's entire life was way too overwhelming. Mm-hmm. So, and unfortunately, I feel like that's what social workers are called on to do, which is unfair. But I found my niche in the law and as a public defender.
It's interesting how, like, both your social work background and your public defense background influenced so much of this work. You mentioned, or you talked earlier about, you know, being elected to Urban City Council and then, or the County Council, and then working in state government for, like, Secretary of State's office. Mm-hmm. How did those roles affect, you know, both? I mean, you talked about this, like, your leadership journey. How do they affect that? But also, more so, how do they affect what you do now? Like, how do you still look at those and learn from those experiences?
Yeah. So my time at the Secretary of State's office, when I knew I wanted to expand my career, that was the, okay, let me get out of, you know, criminal law, and let's, you know, and I got to work for Trey Grayson. He was the Secretary of State at the time, who I didn't know, but knew people who knew him. And, you know, that was probably my first experience in, like, formal government. Mm-hmm. But then to kind of see, because I'd come on his second part of the administration. So to hear him and his staff kind of talk about how they came in, you know, some of the mistakes they may have made. Mm-hmm. You know, just the shift changes, or, you know, the role changes and things like that. Just, and, you know, they were working on this massive project that they ultimately didn't really get to take credit for because of the administration change and term limits and all that stuff. But knowing that government takes some of these projects that need to be done that will help the entire state span over, you know, multiple administrations. And sometimes it's just the luck of the draw when the person that gets to roll it out, you know, be like, hey, it's done, and, you know, take the credit for it. But hopefully I think when the project was finally done, I think, you know, there was thanks to previous administrations, because I think it even started before Trey's administration. But kind of seeing, like, that's government maybe at its finest, you know, something that's really going to help the entire state, and how many different agencies, because it was one stop for Secretary of State, so business filings.
Okay.
And to know it's this massive project, and then, but to see how many different agencies have to be involved, and getting everyone on board and getting everyone to cooperate and kind of putting all, literally moving parts, you know, on different pieces of a puzzle together, and how we need to cooperate, coordinate, to do something that now I think everybody takes for granted. Like, oh yeah, I'll just go on and, you know, renew my filing, you know? I'm like, that took years and years and several administrations and agencies to get done. So I think that was probably, you know, a good example for me in understanding when people really want to improve something, like what it takes and how collaborative people have to be. And, you know, partisanship aside, it's like, let's do this, because mm-hmm. it will benefit everybody. So yeah, I saw that. And then leadership, that was probably my first dip into being a leader, because I was the general counsel, but also did have, was the elections administrator and had someone underneath me, which, you know, was something new for me. And, you know, luckily she was wonderful and knew her job backwards and forwards, but still being the one who had to give the approval or, you know, give still some direction and some guidance. You know, that probably just started me on my way and building relationships with people in the office. Just getting to know employees. You know, obviously I wasn't the boss, but still having to talk to different people and, you know, kind of see, you know, what was their experience when a new administration came, or, you know, how they handle, you know, such change, or, you know, what did they like or what didn't they like, or, you know, what did another Secretary of State do? So understanding, although I was a merit employee, you know, and was even after that, but just kind of getting some guidance about how to handle transitions, even within government, because they're inevitable, especially in when you've got term limited positions. But that also helped me coming in here and trying to remember, okay, yes, people have gotten into a groove and no one was expecting change. So when it comes, not just change itself, you know, nobody really likes change, but then when it comes so unexpected, I try to be sensitive to that, you know, because again, I've got a great staff and they're just trying to do their job. But, you know, when the head leaves, you know, it can be unnerving for people. So I try to be sensitive to that and reflect on, you know, some of the lessons that I heard from people. Because as much as I'd been in government, I'd actually never gone through an administration change. So I didn't have that. I didn't feel that angst. Since I was a merit employee, it wasn't going to affect me, but still just feeling people who were not in the merit system, kind of, I didn't get to experience their angst of what to do next, but knew that conversations were being had, and that's it's just a part of change. And, you know, those that have been through it, they're like, yes, this administration will want to do something. You know, everyone wants to leave their mark, and that's okay. You know, so understanding that about government too, which, shifting to council, I think that was very helpful to know too, that when you deal with 15 people, you know, 16 including the mayor, like, everyone probably comes in with their own agenda and everyone wants to, you know, leave their mark somehow, and trying to figure out, you know, what mark I want to leave versus, you know, how do I, you know, is someone else, what their mark is that going to conflict with what mine is, and how can we work together to, you know, create something new or even help each other, you know, and getting accomplished whatever, you know, we want to. So yeah, that's, and that kind of goes to the collaborative, going back to collaboration of, because that's how I came into council. It's like, okay, well, we all should try to be working together, because again, that's what I saw from state government, is that, yeah, we've got to keep a project moving, and I might not get the glory at the end, but it's still something that needs to be done, and we all need to push it forward, and being on the same page and having disagreements, but still moving forward to get something done for the greater good of the Commonwealth. So that was kind of the mentality that I came in with. It was interesting to see that maybe everyone didn't come in with that mentality. So that was a struggle, but, you know, it was still a good experience. And that it's a different kind of leadership and engagement with people. So, yeah, I think that's, they've all been like smaller leadership roles, I think, but yeah, I've taken away something from each of them, and doing this interview has made me think about that. Like how it has. So yeah.
Happy to hear it's helping you reflect on that. What would you say were some of the biggest struggles you've encountered in your leadership journey? Would you say maybe those administrative changes or something else?
Since I've been here?
In general, for any position you've held?
I'll speak from this position, because I am in the executive position, mm-hmm. Which is very different from, being a manager or being the director. Executive leadership, and I have been able to talk to other executives, whether they're business or in government. I mean, it really is that, the buck stops here. Like, it does end with you, good or bad, at the end of the day. And this is something I also did realize at the Attorney General's office, and something that I shared with a lot of the boards that I represented. Because even though I was general counsel to several different licensing boards that the Attorney General's office contracted with, but at the end of the day, Jack Conway was my boss. And I would tell my boards when they were perhaps going in a direction that was not quite my legal advice or not what I would want them to do, I very much internalized that, because I would say, look, at the end of the day, my job is to make sure Jack Conway's name is not in the newspaper for something I let you all do or I did not discourage you from doing. So I think that's probably, that was a big takeaway from that position, that I've really, and the same with Trey Grayson, but, I think I got to practice a little bit more, at the Attorney General's office, understanding that, that's the big difference. That, and I, because I respect the people that I've worked for, I don't want my legal advice to be something that, or not caution people, mm-hmm. To do something that will get my boss's name in the paper. Cause it's not going to be, at that point, it's not going to be, well, Angela Evans said X, Y, and Z, or let them do. It's like, no, it's going to be Attorney General Conway or Secretary of State, Grayson did X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. And I'm just the kind of person that would not, I'm going to do my best to not make that, to make my boss look bad.
Yeah.
So it is a different level. And so that's what coming over here, now it's like, oh crap, that is me. So, and I think my staff understands that, but it's making sure we have systems and procedures in place to where it will minimize the potential of that happening. Like I said, having standard offers and making sure, my staff is on the same page. If there's something that might be a little more high profile, we've had the conversations of, please think about this, because yes, it's your case, but if it's in the paper, let's make sure you've gone through this thought process of, are you going to be able to justify what you did to me? Mm-hmm. That to me in a conversation that we have, about whatever offer or the situation that's going on. Because that's how I was brought up, raised. I don't know. my legal career. It's at the end of the day, I will take the brunt of it, because that's what I get paid to do. Mm. But also in that, that's been part of what we've done, is set up those processes and those procedures, and making sure we're thinking through and being thoughtful about the actions that we take to make sure, it's like Angela's name is in the paper. So having those conversations.
Do you have examples of toxic leadership you've experienced that you've learned from?
That's a good question. I can say, as a whole, I've realized how blessed I've been to have great supervisors and executives, in whatever organization that I'm in. I've had some experiences where, and it's usually, things that don't happen. Like, you don't address the toxic person.
Okay.
You know, it's because, you know, it's management, right? And HR, unless you went to school to do HR, nobody wants to do HR. You know, we're attorneys, you know, we're like, what is this whole other side of, you know, a business thing that I have to do? No, I just want to practice law. So that is something different for us to have to deal with. But yeah, it's usually been, there's a disruptor or someone who's disruptive, and allowing that person to continue to be disruptive just because they get their work done or because, you know, for whatever reason, you know, they, you know, they're great at fundraising or whatever. It's been a lot. It's mainly been that we're not addressing the toxicity of other people. And then, you know, just broader, just even outside of work, you know, there are people who just like having titles and don't know how to lead and just want to tell people what to do. You know, yeah, people that just want to have the title for the sake of having the title, but don't necessarily have the tools or the skills to be, you know, board chair or committee chair or whatever, you know, whatever those organizations. So that's where I know I've probably seen it. And a lot of them are volunteer situations. So, you know, I give some grace for that too. But no, when you're, whether you're voted into it or you're voluntold to do it, or you're like, okay, well, nobody else will do it, so yes, I'll do it. You know, that's, however you get to that leadership position, like, you need to try and do your best. And but yeah, where I've seen it go sideways is where people just want the title, or they think the title makes them better than everyone else, and then that goes sideways real quick. And that's where I've seen it the worst. So that, I try my best not to be that person. You know, I work for this position. You know, I am in charge ultimately, but I don't want to be the person who said, we'll do it just because I said it.
Yeah.
There are some times where it is that, but, you know, trying to figure out the kind of leader that I want to be does not involve the because I said so, you know. But so many people kind of get their jollies off of saying, oh, because I said so, or I'm the president, so just do it. Or who can't handle being questioned. People that, you know, when you can't ask why to the leader, that's, I find that's where things go awry as well. So yeah, but again, it's, and that's unfortunate because, again, especially volunteer, you know, organizations or, you know, nonprofits, things like that. You know, you can lose membership because of that. And I've seen that happen.
I've seen similar things on boards and from volunteer things. Something you see sometimes, as you said, like, it's something to be empathetic about too, especially if someone's like voluntold to do something, it can be tough.
Yeah. And I saw, you know, with, and I had several different boards, and I won't name which licensing board it was, but it was always fun for me to see the different ways my boards operated, although they all had the same authority, you know. I was like, yeah, your professions are vastly different, but you all have the same issues. Like, you're still here to, like, govern your profession. And one day your profession will love you because you put this, you know, regulation into place. The next day they'll hate you because you put this regulation into place. But yeah, there were some that handled it much better than others, who communicated with their constituency, their professions, and then others that just kind of ruled with the iron fist of like, nope, this is what we're going to do it, or how we're going to do it. And then there were some boards that they just allowed the chair to do whatever the chair wanted to do. The chair may have been the expert, but that doesn't mean you negate your duty as a board member either. So that never seemed to go well either. So, so it was, I got to see a lot of different things, different ways of operating, different professions. You know, the counselors were very much inclusive in trying to get everyone on board, whereas others were, you know, may have taken it from a more business-like stance. And, that was seeing their styles, and the ones that had more trouble were the ones that usually it was a leadership issue. But yeah, they were volunteers as well. That's the leaders that don't engage the rest of, you know, their executive board or whomever, their executive team. I've seen that come to the demise of organizations, unfortunately.
Appreciate you sharing that. What would you say is your overall leadership style or philosophy?
I'm still learning what my style is. You know, truth be told, like I've been in this executive role. It's my third year now. Like I said, executive is much different than, you know, being one of 15 or, you know, even in an organization, a nonprofit or something. So, you know, I certainly want input from people. You know, I don't want to be the one that says, just do it because I said so. I do want to have a collaborative, I'm more collaborative. I want people to, you know, understand why we're doing some things. But balancing that with, you know, sometimes we just need to do it. Like, you don't get an explanation for every decision I make. I do want to be, approachable. You know, I want people to know that I do care, you know, them as individuals, but then also as the office as a whole. Mm-hmm. And my goal is to make this office not just efficient, but effective. And I want my employees to feel like they are effective. And that we are actually doing good work. I should probably have a better answer for that after 3 years, but now I'm trying to work on the type of leader that I want to be. I'm still learning how to be, you know, direct but stern, mm-hmm. open but decisive, you know, and each person that I've brought in, you know, I'm learning how to, you know, how they receive information, you know, trying to be willing to like grow for me. And cause I want someone that's got a good team. Mm-hmm. And I think part of having a really good team is learning how to communicate most effectively with each team member. So I'm working on that because communication is hard. being able to give people a vision of what we're doing and why we're doing it. So a lot of things I'm still learning, like, that sounds great, but how do I do it?
Yeah.
Trying to be the person that, you know, people know that, like, there's some of these things that you don't want me practicing, but, you know, that I'm someone who I will do my best to try and get the support that you need to do your job most effectively. I actually care about the people in their office, but also that we have a job to do and we're here for the people of the county, of the Commonwealth. And that's ultimately, we need to do our best for them. Mm-hmm. You know, my name's on the door, but I I cannot do this whole job all by myself. And so again, I want to be appreciative and share my gratitude with people. And I hope I do that, you know. But again, learning people's love languages are different. So how do you do that with an office of, like, you know, 50, 60 people? So yeah, that's kind of the things I'm working on and figuring out.
I, for my own, like, I guess I have my what I call my 3 M's of leadership, being an effective motivator, being a competent manager, and then being a supportive mentor. I know you already talked
about that. Oh gosh, that's so concise. I can take that. See, I'm still learning.
Thank you. But yeah, I know you've talked, of course, about the management aspect of the mentorship aspect a lot. But yeah, do you see those as 3 separate roles in what you do, or like 3 things that are tied together, or how do you view those three, my 3 M's?
Those are 3 very different things. Three very different things. And I think for me, probably the mentor is the easiest. Mm-hmm. 'Cause again, that's just, hey, I'm here for you. And not just, but you know, I mean, I feel like there's some I've given advice to, you know, just, I forget how long I've been practicing and how how long I've been on this earth. So yeah, there is some knowledge that I do have. And just whether it's, you know, in my career or just my own path to being more self-aware, there have been some things I've been able to share with individuals, whether on my staff or just, you know, attorneys starting out or young women. I say specifically young women. So, I mean, I think mentor is the easiest. I think that's, you know, letting people know I'm here for you. Please consider me a resource. You know, some will take you up on it more than others. You know, but for me, that's just kind of building relationships, which is, it comes a little more naturally to me. Motivator. I was not a cheerleader in high school, so, or junior high. And I'm the one I'm more skeptical about life. And so motivating is a challenge for me, because we're all motivated by different things. Like, you know, it's like the intrinsic and extrinsic, you know, thing about your job. You know, well, I'm just one of those people that, you know, I want to do a good job just because of me. Like, I don't necessarily need someone to tell me, hey, you're doing a great job. It helps, but, you know, the jobs that I'm at, I find value in doing them regardless if anyone ever tells me, hey, you're doing a good job. And that's just kind of how I've reflected. Like, even if no one said, you know, thank you, Miss Evans, while I was a public defender, like, I still knew I was doing a good job. Like, even my worst client, I'm like, well, I still got you a better offer than, you know, than you ever would have gotten on your own or something like that. Or that, you know I put myself into those cases. So, so for me, it's difficult for me to now be the external kind of motivator for an office. Mm-hmm. And I'm learning how to do that. 'Cause again, that's where some people really thrive. Mm-hmm. So that's something I'm legit working on. Especially some of the work that we have. I mean, we're talking about children that are abused, or, you know, parents that just refuse to pay, you know, child support, and mm-hmm. they want to yell at you because, mm-hmm. well, they haven't seen the kid in 5 years. I'm like, well, that's not our problem, but you still have an obligation to pay. Or, you know, I'm sorry that, you know, you've gotten behind, or that you're starting in the hole, or, you know, whatever, you know, what brought you to our office for child support. You know, it's a tough thing to deal with every day. Mm-hmm. And again, some of the stories that we see people that come through the court system regularly. Okay, what are we going to do with them this time? You know, so it's difficult to try and keep people's motivation high sometimes because of the topics that we deal with a lot. And again, I try to check in, you know, be that, how's everybody doing? But sometimes it's just, you know, our job never ends, you know, especially over in child support. Like, we've got 16,000 to 18,000 cases, and we're never going to get caught up on like child support. There's always going to be a new batch of cases coming in. And, you know, it's, so trying to motivate there is a different type of motivation for maybe just my general prosecutor that just, you know, sees the same person every 6 months or something like that. So, motivation, being the motivator, sometimes you got to tell yourself, you know, a good story to help you then share it with them. You know, it's kind of like, not a fake it till you make it, but hey, even if you don't fully believe it, you need to share it with them because that's what they need to hear. And so I'm genuinely still working on that. Cause that's not intrinsically, you know, my nature. A manager is very different too, cause that's balancing, you know, the needs of people, you know, the needs of people versus the needs of the office. Yes, we all come in with, you know, we're all people and have stuff going on, but having to explain that shouldn't impact your work, or, you know, that is impacting your work and we need you to actually leave that at the door today, or, you know, just figuring out how to get people in the right places, like, which I guess is kind of maybe part of being a mentor. You know, maybe this person isn't the right fit for, you know, this division. So, okay, well, we need a space, or we have space available over in another division. We don't know how they're going to feel about it, but maybe we, you know, move them over there, which is a management decision, but maybe it's also a mentor. Like, maybe I see something in this person that they don't necessarily see. Sometimes convincing people that, no, this, I think this will be a good fit, or, yeah, I know that's where you want to be, but we need you over here. So yeah, that's a completely different role. You know, there's some mentorship in that, maybe even, you know, being the motivator of like, okay, you know, we know this isn't what you want to do, but this is where we need you. But no, I think those are very different roles and skills that I think the executive needs to have. You know what, I'd like to have all of those, but that's very hard. You have to learn those, and yeah, I don't think you certainly don't learn them overnight. And like I said, some you're more inclined to do or be able to do than others, but yeah, those are great. I need to keep those.
A mentor of mine inspired me to come up with them, so.
Oh, okay. I will take it. Thank you.
Oh, of course. But yeah, I appreciate you answering all those questions about leadership development. Now I want to ask a few questions about kind of the local global context. Kind of call these my fun questions.
Okay. Not going to get me in trouble, are they?
I don't think so. But what are leadership lessons you've learned from different global sources, whether from books, movies, TVs, or even like pop culture sources?
Like all the cliches, you know, leader, heavy is, you know, the head that wears the crown. You know, I mean, all of those, like it is so true. I mean, it's clearly I need to read more, but it's all of those things that we've heard. I understand it. And it takes on more meaning, like obviously since I'm now in this role. Understanding or knowing that executives, you know, hearing different stories, I guess, about them and, you know, what they do. Like, yeah, it's different when I look like, I said, all I do is go to meetings and stuff, but I also go to sleep thinking about X, Y, and Z. I'm like, yeah, that's what these, you know, executives and, you know, true leaders do. Like, they're thinking about this stuff day and night. It might not show, but it's so, and it's kind of more of what I've been told. I'm sure this is in books somewhere, but it's like, yeah, that's why you have to write things down. That's why you need the time to like just schedule out some time for yourself to brainstorm everything you want to do. All of those cliches come in and how I, they just mean a little bit more now.
Who would you say, do you have any, your most important leadership role models, whether different like local or global leaders, and whether fictional or real people?
You know what? I really don't have one, because the people that I thought about, I mean, it's leadership in different ways, you know, whether it's, you know, an activist or, you know, a president, you know, political versus, you know, because it's all different. Like, it's more of, I can admire how people do things differently. Because, you know, I don't know if you want to talk about it, you know, Bill Gates or Steve Jobs or whatever, you know, a genius that comes to, you know, bring something like that to fruition versus, you know, civil rights leaders, you know, leadership, you know, the person that's, or whether it's the person at the front, you know, will take very broad, everyone knows, you know, Dr. King or, you know, the name that always gets confused with mine, you know, and Angela Davis, you know, you know, activism leadership versus, you know, executive or, government, you know, leadership, you know, can always, you know, go way back with real safe names like Roosevelt, like, you know, but, you know, some of those are safer spaces maybe to be a leader. Like I said, a business, corporations, your business, you get to do whatever. But, you know, versus someone who literally might get killed being the leader and the advocate. You know, some that have more charisma than others, or some that, you know, just have the passion or who can just motivate people and get things done. But I mean, it's all kind of still the same thing. They still had to have people around them to get things done. So, I mean, I'll leave in you, and this is weird to say, but it's just, it's one of my quirks and what I like doing, watching like cult documentaries, you know, cause it's its own weird form of leadership, right? Like, it's very manipulative, but it's just of when, because people are always, you have people that want to be led, who can be led, you know, in the most positive to the most sinister kind of way. Like, how do you motivate them to do the good or whatever your vision is? So it's not, yeah, I can't just pick one person, because I'm not sure I really even think of myself as a leader or it's still a struggle for me to think like that. So it's not like I was not one of those politicians that, you know, one, I didn't study history. I didn't major in history. I know a lot of, you know, or political science. So I know a lot of lawyers did, but that was not my major. So I was not studying this to create a 5-10 year plan. And again, my leadership has just been be effective, you know, help, you know, pitch in. So, so that's something I'm actually catching up on. Like, oh, now I need to read these books about leadership. Okay, exactly. What is, highly effective people, 7 habits of highly effective people, or, all of those different things. Like, I was like, I'm just doing what I do. Yeah. So, yeah, I've got to play catch up on that stuff. So from this point, it's just kind of been realizing, okay, charismatic. Mm-hmm. Okay, you can be a leader. Like, okay. Or you've just got a great plan and people are going to jump on board. Or you're just, in fact, the boss, and so they're going to jump on board. So I need to do a little more study about that now. But not one person. Yeah. Sorry.
No, that makes sense. And I think it sounds like, yeah, you look more to the style or the ideas or the, like, the leadership style itself more so than, like, you know, looking up too much to like one person, right?
Yeah, because I think part of how I was just raised, going back to mom being a teacher, and working in, you know, the association. And I mean, I always knew teachers, you got to work together. Like this is your class, and you know, you've got two other teachers that are teaching the same class. It's always been collaborative for me. So, I mean, you had the principal, but you know, that was, I was on the teacher level, and it was, okay, yeah, you're the president, but president organizations, which my mom was. So I got to see it from that perspective too. I was like, but you still need like everybody else on this board or in the organization to come to do what you do. So, yeah, I've never looked at it as, oh, okay, what did this great leader do? And and there was actually a class when I went to Princeton that was on leaders, and they shifted it, and it was about presidents. So that's why I felt like maybe I was going to backtrack. I'm like, okay, this is the class I should have taken, you know, in undergrad, thinking about leadership and all that. And they actually, he actually switched it to civil rights leaders. And I was like, well, okay, I kind of know about these, this part of history, but... so even with that, it was still, okay, you've got the charismatic people, but you still needed people in the background. And then making sure, you know, even people in the background still got the same respect and how challenging that was. And that people who were actually leading were still in the shadows. You know, so it's, and some wanted to be in the shadows, but then some others were, you know, actually pushed to the shadows, you know, and there, and leadership sometimes collectively just decide who our leader is going to be for just because they look the part. So I've never taken a lot of, I hadn't taken real stock into that. Some people are natural about it. Some people are chosen, whether that's chosen by a select few or chosen, you know, by democracy. But yeah, I try not to get too focused on an individual or type because the more we learn, we're like, oh, well that person just, you know, looked the part or, you know, played the role or that. That victim was more acceptable in society, so let's bring that person as the face of, you know, whatever movement. So leadership's an interesting thing when you think about it from that aspect.
How do you how do you look at a global leadership or what's going on around the world, and how does it affect you as a leader here in Kentucky?
Okay, let me try not to get on my soapbox. we are lacking in real leadership. When I mean leadership, people with vision, with conviction, with the desire to improve society for the greater good. I think we are lacking in that. Leaders, and I'll speak in government, leaders need to not just the loudest voice is not the leader, doesn't make you a leader. Being in charge is being different than being the leader. I think we're kind of seeing that on the federal level, that we have someone that was elected to be the leader. There's not questions of whether or not that person is actually in charge. Maybe even universally, that's what's going on, even internationally. But definitely here in the U.S., we're the loudest people become the leaders. And maybe even in Kentucky, it's probably the same. But then we also have people in leadership that don't understand the need to strategize and don't understand how to use their power, their platforms in the most effective way. And I think that can hurt, you know, they might be very well-intentioned, but that can also Curtis, depending on what side of a topic that you're on. Good leaders need to be forecasting. I think that's part of their role. Like, they're not just responding to what's happening now. They're thinking, you know, 2, 3 years, months, whatever increments ahead. Like, it's not just having a plan, but being able to adjust that plan and, like, and effectively strategize. I think we lack leaders that understand how to strategize in whatever political environment that they're in. There's a time to advocate. Well, there's always a time to advocate, but advocating strategically is something that we're lacking. And leadership requires people who are willing to say, look, this is how it's going to be. Just to be able to declare, this is right, this is wrong, and we're not going to stand for wrong. And it's a fine line, you know, because you can, and that's where different people have their role. Like, when I say going to, you know, leadership, leaders in advocacy, you know, a leader of a protest is very different than a leader in government.
Yeah.
Like, that's because there are things a leader in government can't say necessarily to protest, or perhaps wouldn't be as advantageous. Because again, when you're in that kind of body and a legislative body, you still have to build relationships. So that's why I tell people, everyone doesn't need to run for office. We need people out there beating the drum sometimes, and who can beat it as loud as it needs to be and say exactly what needs to be said. What I think is we're lacking leaders that are willing to put themselves on the line. And again, everybody isn't in the position to do that, but there's also, they're lacking strategy in using their power, their authority to the best of, that can help move the needle and move for change. I think that's something that I've seen everybody, people get in leadership or get platforms, you know, and then they want to be all over the place. Like, but is that your lane? Like, your lane is over here. Figure out how you can best strategize and lead in that lane. And then if you see a problem over here, then that's where you use your voice and your power to then go advocate for this kind of change. But I think you see people who just want to attack everything, address, you know, everything. And again, well-meaning, but we're lacking a real strategy in how to do that, and being able to use the power that we have in whatever leadership role that the people have to be the most effective.
My last two questions here. First, I'll ask, I appreciate you talking about the nature of, like, yeah, like protest versus governing. I think that leads into this well. You know, with April being Second Chance Month, and we'll release the episode in April, how do you, like, look at things like Second Chance Month? And then, you know, we've seen, like, I mean, local, state, national, but also global movements for, like, criminal justice reform and addressing that, and addressing policing. Like, how do you reflect on that in your work?
I'm going back to my bachelor's is in social work. So I think for me, it's a fundamental belief, and actually beyond social work. I mean, just my faith, you know, teaches me that we're all human and faulty, and I have to forgive, you know, not that there are not consequences to, you know, wrongs that we do, but we all get chance after chance after chance. I mean, I'm a Christian. Like that is one of our pillars. Like, God will forgive you every time you confess your sins. Like that's, and he doesn't love you any less. That's just the fundamentals of my faith. So I can't not believe in second chances. Mm-hmm. So, and then adding the social work, you know, education to it, having the empathy and understanding that everyone doesn't start at the same place. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, what the example I would, well, not an example, but explaining to people, like, oh, how can you, you know, represent, you know, criminals? I'm like, well, you know, some people were born into families that just commit crimes. That is the norm for them. They didn't ask to be born into that family, mm-hmm, any more than I got to choose what family I was born into. And it's always that, well, you know, at some point, you know, right from wrong. Like, yes, that is true. We also, again, you're not born into a family where wrong is right, mm-hmm, and wrong is fine. And it takes the internal, like, an amazing amount of, like, strong will constitution within yourself. Like, at some point, your DNA, you were just that person that says, I'm going to go against the grain of my entire family. Mm-hmm. But, you know, no one wants to be the oddball, mm-hmm, of their family. And that is, it is more common than people believe it. Like, when jail is just part of growing up, it takes a will I'm not even sure I would have to go against that or choose a different path. Are the paths available? Yes, they are. But again, when you're not in an environment where you can see them readily, you don't see other people taking those paths, mm-hmm, then it becomes less visible. So there are some that, you know, they get to a life of crime that way. There are others that, yes, choose it, who them being in jail, in prison, is against the grain. Mm-hmm. And again, but there are consequences for that. And it's interesting to see how society is now realizing, oh, we can't keep everyone in jail forever. No, and that's what social workers have been saying from, you know, the dawn of time. You know, even if someone serves out a full 20-year sentence, unless they're 80, they're going to be coming back into society at some point. So we have to plan for that. Mm. We have to give them tools that, because at some point they will be back among us. And this is like the whole philosophical, you know, discussion you have in criminal law. Oh, you know, yeah, you know that, like, are we a punitive, you know, nation, or are we, you know, reformative? And we obviously, I think we lean towards punitive, and haven't fully leaned into a reformative, mm-hmm, country. I think we're getting there. So yeah, I think people are now understanding that it's expensive. I mean, just the practical part of it, you, mm-hmm, know, that's a discussion that we had, well, on city council. And even when I started as county attorney, like, and COVID even showed that, ooh, our jails, we have a lot, they're either overcrowded or they're understaffed, mm-hmm, or we just have too many people in them for COVID or whatever, you know, so we need to think of alternatives, or it's just an expensive institution. And so how do we reduce the cost? You know, what other things can we do? Just, you know, for the practicality of it, you know, forget helping people, you know, just how do we reduce the population but still maintain, you know, the safety of our society. So I think we are leaning more into that, and I think we should. Now, of course, there are still consequences. Can we save everyone? No. Like, I say that with all of my social work, I, you know, Christian belief, like, no, everyone is not going to accept the help that's given to them. But that's true of a lot of things, you know? What, people have all kinds of vices, and are they going to accept the help? Some will just not, some others will. It'd be down the road. And so I think we're becoming more accepting of that and giving people the options. I mean, it's amazing just in the 24 years now that I've been practicing to see the shift in the court system. Because we, you know, first finally started out with drug court. But I'm not sure we had drug court when I started, but now it's not just drug court. It's mental health court. You know, it's, we have a veterans court, and we have, you know, rocket dockets for people that, you know, first time drug offenses, like, okay, let's speed this through and get you the help that you need. So, we are moving towards that more. Are there things we can still do? Yes, but we're getting there. But again, I think we're starting to understand that being imprisoned, being in custody, you know, it should be reserved for people that we are truly afraid of.
Yeah.
And who have truly, you know, scared society, you know, or, you know, it needs to be reserved for the worst of crimes. And that everyone is not a lost cause. So, and we see that in the prison programs that we have, that, you know, even someone convicted of murder, you know, they're still, they can still be productive in prison, and can still, you know, offer some education to someone out, you know, to prevent them from going down that path, or can just be productive, and can have a purpose even behind bars. So yeah, I think we're leaning towards that, giving them a chance to re-enter society and be productive, because that's ultimately what we should want people to do. And so I think society's starting to catch up with the rest of us social workers. But yeah, so I'm hopeful now. Again, I think it requires, you know, people staying in their lanes and doing those things. But I think going back to advocacy and people, leaders in different ways, expressing what needs to happen, and collaborating, and. So yeah, I mean, I believe in it. Again, do I think everyone is going to take advantage of it? No. But doesn't mean we should stop, like, trying or give up on people, or, you know, still not have some hope that maybe, you know.
So. Yeah, those second chances are very important. But yeah, my last question here is, what advice do you have for leaders, whether individual leaders, organizations, like protesters or movements, like you mentioned, who want to put Kentucky on the global map, or more so Lexington on the global map, and show the world what our Commonwealth has to offer?
Although we're a small state by comparison, or, you know, we're not a metropolis, being, you know, Lexington specifically, that... we do have a vision for, you know, the city, the state, really for the country, and that I'm thinking in terms of, like, what I would like for us to be able to do is to truly collaborate and go back to perhaps be a leader in this, you know, highly charged political climate, but that somehow we can move beyond that. And, you know, I would love for us to be able to be the leader in that, to kind of push back on our highly charged partisan politics right now to do what is really best for Kentucky, for Lexington, because we are a state that I believe personally, and I'll say because of Mitch McConnell and his leadership for all of these years, however you feel about it, like, he's allowed Kentucky to fight above its weight class for so long. And so we need strong leaders on both sides of the aisle to keep us in that, on that kind of stage.
Yeah.
So we need to work together. Like, we, our leadership needs to work together to do that, because I mean, we've gotten millions and millions of dollars just because of the seniority and the strategy, you know, honestly, of one man, or his ability to maneuver. And I think it's going to take all of our leaders, you know, from, you know, federal to state, even to, you know, some local leaders, to be able to do that, to maintain that. Because we are a recipient of a lot of the government aid that is now threatened. So that would be my hope, and that we have leaders who can, individuals in power, or a leader can rise up, whatever, to explain and help motivate and encourage that kind of collaboration. Because it really, for me, it is concerning that, you know, while, you know, we do have, you know, we are bringing in businesses, it's still fragile. Like, it's still kind of a new thing. Like, Governor Beshear has done a lot of stuff and brought in a lot of business, but we now have manufacturing that's kind of under threat based on tariffs and things like that. So it, I think now, especially for Kentucky, because we are, we're on such a trajectory of getting new business and kind of creating a new, maybe a new identity for us, or helping shift our identity, it's going to take... It's my hope that we can move out of that partisanship so we can keep on that trajectory, because it was, I think it was going well. And so that requires hard conversations and people being bold enough and willing to have those conversations and to listen and to just, let's be honest about where Kentucky falls in, you know, the 50 states and, you know, power, authority, you know, whatever, influence, maybe that's a better word. And how do we use that influence for the best, for the betterment of Kentucky? And that is my hope. I don't know if it's going that direction, but that would be my hope, and that even other states would see that's that's why you work with people. Because again, California could go off on its own. It's its own country and could survive, but most of us can't. And so I would like to hope that maybe we will realize that, and our leadership will move beyond the partisanship and really understand that, because we cannot survive otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I appreciate you sharing the great leaders who've done that work, and that's great advice for the Commonwealth, and it sounds like a lot of the work you're doing here is moving that forward as well.
I'm trying to do my little part, you know, still figuring out how I fit into the big puzzle, but yeah, I mean, that's Fayette County, as I'm constantly told by my fellow county attorneys, are like, you're the second largest county in the state. I'm like, yes. And so how can I help? Yeah, I understand what impacts me, or, you know, how, with child support specifically, like we are measured by performance. And the first thing I heard, coming in from child support division, you know, Fayette County, Jefferson County, when you all do well, the rest of the state does well. Mm-hmm. So, like, okay, yeah, that's kind of intimidating, you know? Like, well, how do we do well? And, you know, and what resources do I need to get to make sure we do well? And, you know, but guess what? The problems that I have, which I tell my fellow county attorneys too, are the same ones that you all have. Mm-hmm. They're just on a different scale. So, you know, I don't want them to think that, you know, just because I have, you know, HR or whatever, you know, some more people, more staff to help me in some areas, that I don't have those same problems. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, we still had, you know, turnover issues. We still, you know, we still are behind on cases. Like, it's, you know, it, same thing. And we still have repeat offenders that we don't know what to do with. Mm-hmm. Or they're not taking the services that are offered. We still don't have enough, you know, beds for people to go to when they're ready to go into treatment. Like, it's all the same things. Yes, we have a lot, mm-hmm. but we still don't have enough. Just Hardin County, you know, all these other counties, we are all still in the same boat. That's why we have our association, why we advocate, and going back to why we have leadership to do things like that. So yeah, that's, it's still trying to figure out where I fit in, but willing to do my part.
Cool. Thank you for doing that part. But yeah, thank you so much for taking the time for this interview. It's been great to see your office. Great to meet you. Great to hear all these lessons in leadership. Just really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate the invitation.
Of course.
That concludes my episode with Angela Evans, a dedicated leader who has given her career to public service and equal justice. I really appreciate her deep understanding, not just of the state and local policy process, but of the gaps that need to be addressed in our community to serve the public. You can learn more about her and her office's work by visiting FayetteCountyAttorney.com. Again, FayetteCountyAttorney.com. My next episode, which will be released in May, features Maddie Duff, the student body president at the University of Kentucky. Remember to live local and think global, fellow changemakers.